You're listening to a podcast from Jubilee Church, Farnham. To find out more, visit www.jubilee.church.
Hi everyone and welcome. It's great to be with you today. I want to take a moment to welcome all the Jubilee Church Farnham regulars. I have been missing you guys and I look forward to when we can meet up again in person. I also want to welcome anyone that's here for the first time, or perhaps you've been joining us over the last few weeks. We love visitors at Jubilee Church, and so you are very welcome. We have just completed our Foundations of Faith preaching series. We looked at what is salvation, what is worship, what is the Bible, among other topics such as who is the Father, who is the Son, and last week Sean did who is the Holy Spirit. If any of that sounds helpful and you haven't listened yet, please do go onto our website at jubilee.church, click on the media page, and have a listen. And now, we move to the next phase. We are going to be looking at the whole area of identity. And I want to say right at the start of today that it's really important to see the next 2 weeks as a single entity. If you watch or listen to this week without next week, it will be like having a hamburger without fries. It will be half a meal. This week, we'll be looking at identity formation through our culture. And next week, we'll look at identity formation through Christ. When I set up the preaching program for 2020 late last year, I didn't have a clue we would be in Zoom land with the world and the grips of a crisis so vast and unprecedented that every aspect of every day has changed radically. And yet, in the midst of the crisis, with the utter tragedy of lost loved ones and families changed forever, we also have other serious consequences beginning to ripple out. Issues of mental health and well-being are coming to the fore. Questions of purpose and what am I living for are bubbling to the surface in a way that wouldn't have been permitted before. And core issues around identity and who we are seem ever more relevant. One of the sharpest reliefs I've noticed as the crisis has continued has been the growing realization of the fragility of our lives. The sense of control we convinced ourselves we had has been popped like a balloon. Our ease and seeming enjoyment of working all hours to get to Friday, a glass of wine, binging Netflix and brunch, now feels hollow and beckons questions. How did we get so comfortable with being comfortable? Understanding our identity, not only in the moment of crisis, but equally as we begin to emerge from it, is critical for all of us, whether Christian or not. In the midst of the tragedy and lost lives, in the midst of the heroes of the NHS and carers, in the midst of the economic impact, in the midst of the uprising of Captain Tom and his personal efforts to raise over 16 million for the NHS, we have a moment of enforced pause. It's a moment not to be missed. It's a moment to reflect and pray, seek answers to questions that perhaps, whilst you were running at full speed and the pace of life before, you just didn't have the time or inclination to ask. And so today, we will take the time and have the inclination to ask these questions. We're going to look at how identity formation happens through the culture we live in. And before I go any further, I want to highlight two authors who I've drawn on heavily for today. The first is Charles Taylor, a Canadian Catholic philosopher who has written a couple of brilliant books. The first one is this one here, and it's called Sources of the Self: The Making of Modern Identity. And if you are interested in this area of identity formation, it's required reading. He also wrote another, perhaps more well-known book called The Secular Age, and both are outstanding. But be warned, they are not an easy read. Brilliant in many ways, but dense and at times difficult to read. The second author is Tim Keller, and particularly his book, Making Sense of God. Keller does all the hard yards digesting Taylor and others and delivers In Making Sense of God, a much more readable book. So I draw heavily on both authors, their books, and some of their talks, and want to give credit to them for most of what I say today. The reason why I want to spend some time with you on this is that if Christians simply say that the identity formation within our culture is not biblical, well, that may be true, but at the same time, it may not sound very plausible to someone outside the faith. If we simply wag the finger and say it's wrong, we may do ourselves and who we're having this conversation with a disservice. What may prove to be more fruitful is to try and pull back from the culture, which is extremely difficult to do, and I'll talk about that in a moment, and critique some of the aspects of identity formation through our culture. This is vitally important for all of us to understand, because every culture imposes on its members its way of doing identity formation. And it doesn't ask your permission, and it doesn't tell you what it's doing. Every generation, whether ancient or modern, whether first century Rome or 21st century in the UK, every culture has a way of giving its members an identity. And by identity, I mean a sense of self and a sense of worth. Every culture says, this is how you get a sense of self and a sense of worth. And it doesn't ask you if you're okay with that. It's just imposed upon you. It also doesn't tell you what it's doing. The culture just acts upon you. It imposes a sense of self and a sense of worth. And this is going on all the time. We often miss it. If I asked you today, how does culture impose the process of identity formation on you? You might very well say, what? What are you talking about? You see, we so often relate to culture and how it forms us and shapes us the way a fish relates to water. We are so immersed in it, we don't even notice. It's like, what are you talking about? I'm just living here. In having this conversation today, I hope to make some aspects of this process visible to you. My hope is that through today, each one of us can see the culture we are all swimming in and see the ways in which that culture is shaping us and forming us to a greater or lesser degree. So identity, it's a sense of self and a sense of worth. But what is that? Let's begin with a sense of self. Let's think of it this way. You have all these roles. Maybe you're a parent. You're also a child, a husband, a dentist, a brother. But in all of those different roles, what is the core you? What is the core you that is true in all of those roles? And is it perhaps what you're living for? Another way to think about this sense of self is to ask, what are you exchanging your life for? Or perhaps we find it by asking, what is the greatest good you are working towards? You get a sense of self from what you think is the most important thing in life. It's the answer to that question that ultimately gives you a sense of self. Because no matter what else you are doing, whatever role you're playing, it's the aspect that is true in all of those areas. A sense of self, a sense of worth, on the other hand, comes from who your ultimate validator is. Who do you look to in terms of validating what you do, how you live, and who you are? To put it another way, who gets to tell you whether you're living up to your ideals, whether you are serving your highest good properly? So, what is the most important thing you are living for? And who do you give the authority to tell you whether you are living according to that greatest good? Charles Taylor, in his book, gives a history of how identity in culture has been formed, and his overview goes like this. Starting back with the ancient culture and civilizations, Taylor says that culture imposed its identity formation upon you primarily through the notion of honor. The greatest thing to live for was honor, the honor of your people, yourself, and your clan. And what honor meant back in these civilizations was to die in battle if you were a man, or to have children if you were a woman, which, by the way, was really dangerous at the time and seen as highly honorable. In both instances, dying in battle or childbirth meant that you were sacrificing yourself for your family, your people. It was the only way that your people were going to survive, fend off the attackers who wanted to enslave you, or have children. And both were heroic ways of making sure your people survived. If you died in that process, then the validation was given by your family, by your people. You were a person of honor, and honor was the best thing to live for. What we see here is that the most important thing to live for was determined outside of yourself. Honor was the greatest thing to live for, and your people determined that. And it was your people who validated you, If your people called you a person of honor, then you had a sense of self and a sense of worth. Now let's jump forward a few hundred years and we get to the philosophers like Aristotle and Plato, and things begin to change a little. These thinkers spoke of a sacred moral order, if you like, a cosmic transcendent order. The Greek and Roman philosophers of the time used to describe this cosmic moral order by the Greek word logos. Interestingly, the Bible uses the same word to describe Jesus in the Gospel of John and chapter 1. It goes like this: in the beginning was the Word. That's the English translation of the word logos. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We might today describe this as something like a set of moral absolutes. But back in ancient Greece and Rome, they spoke of the logos as the cosmic order. These Greek and Roman philosophers believed there was a sacred moral order, a way that human beings ought to live, and that identity formation was wrapped up in aligning yourself to that logos, that sacred or cosmic moral order. There was general agreement that the moral order was out there, external to yourself, and your job was to sacrifice your selfish motivations and align yourself with it. And if you did that, the community would validate you. The community would say, you're a person of virtue, of honor, and of moral worth. So in all ancient times, the moral good you were serving was outside of yourself, and the validator was also outside of yourself. Taylor calls this the traditional identity. Let's jump ahead again a few hundred years. Taylor proposes that the modern identity came in three stages: early modernity, romanticism, and lastly, post-modernity. So firstly, early modernity, the 16th and 17th centuries, which we also call the Enlightenment. And this is where the first step change began to happen. You see, early modern people still believed that there was an external moral order, but for the first time in history, they said you don't find that moral order via tradition, you definitely don't find it from the Bible, and you don't find it by asking anybody else. You discern that external moral order by rationality, by your own thinking. You think deeply on these things, and you discern what they are. By the time we hit Romanticism, that is the very late 18th century into the 19th, thinkers of this age still believed that there was an external cosmic order to be found. It was found still out there, but the way you discerned it was to go deep inside yourself. So not just thought, and this was no longer a solely rational exercise, but rather you went deep into your heart and into your feelings and emotions. And then comes the real kicker. When you arrive at the postmodern era, say post-World War II, Taylor argues that the process that had been going on over these phases finally completes. The inward turn is fully realized. The postmodern thinkers move away from the idea of an eternal sacred order, and they say that you go inside yourself and you don't just discern what that order is, you determine it. It's a huge shift, and it's underpinned by the idea that all moral value is relative and socially constructed. And finally, we have now, as Taylor says, a completely internal self. There are no moral absolutes. You determine them for yourself, and you are also, and this is vital here, the ultimate validator. Nobody tells you what is right and wrong. That is determined by your interior self. So let's just recap on the huge transition that has happened in identity formation in the Western culture. Firstly, the determination of the moral good or cosmic order has moved from the external to the internal. Second, the very stuff of the self, that sense of self, moves from duties to desires. The reversal here is staggering. In the traditional identity, you were basically your duties, and you sacrificed your desires to become and fulfill your duties. And you don't, in the modern identity, you are your desires, and you don't let anyone else tell you that those desires aren't legitimate or valuable. Third, the place of the argument has totally shifted. In the traditional identity, you go outside of yourself to be taught what the moral order is, And then you come back inside and you argue with yourself, you argue with your heart, and you say, come on, heart, you cannot be simply and only just what you want to be. I need to align to that moral order. In the modern identity, you start inside, determine the moral order, and then you go outside to argue with your culture to say, you have to validate me because I have determined who I am. It's completely the opposite. And this leads me to the last contrast. In traditional identity, you don't validate yourself. It's someone else that validates you. It's your family or your people, but it's not you. However, in the modern identity, you are the only and ultimate validator. Philip Reif, another commentator, in his book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, says that the modern identity is not just different to the traditional, but a complete reversal. Up to this point, just about every other culture in the world said the problem with the world is selfish individuals, and our means of salvation is to connect with the external sacred order. We are the first culture in the history of the world that says that the problem with the world is everyone telling me that there is an external sacred order that I have to live by, and the only real salvation is found when every individual is free to live his or her life as he or she determines. In essence, the modern identity says that the one thing we need to be redeemed from is the idea that we need to be redeemed. And remember what I said at the beginning. Culture doesn't tell you it's forming and shaping you this way. It imposes itself upon you, and we are so often unaware. But let's take a look at some examples of how this happens and in the arts and media that express this idea. Let's look at one of the foundational narratives of our recent past, Frozen. You're already singing, I know. Go on, let it go. But hang on. Let's take a look at the words, the message that shaped a generation of young people, and indeed some older people. The wind is howling like this swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in, heaven knows I've tried. Don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. It's funny how some distance makes everything seem small, and the fears that once controlled me can't get to me at all. It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. Let it go, let it go. I am one with the wind and the sky. Let it go, let it go. You'll never see me cry. Here I stand and here I stay. Let the storm rage on. I mean, it's crazy, right? There we are all singing along with our young children, applauding Elsa as she basically destroys her kingdom for her own personal self-discovery. It's going to lead to mass starvation and death. And we're all clapping away and say, well, doesn't she look amazing? And it's a catchy tune. But why are we clapping? It carries on. My power flurries through the air into the ground. My soul is spiraling in frozen fractals all around. And one thought crystallizes like an icy blast. I'm never going back. The past is in the past. Let it go. The cold never bothered me anyway. Let it go, and I'll rise like the break of the dawn. Let it go, that perfect girl is gone. Here I stand in the light of day, let the storm rage on. You see, this is a very powerful narrative. There's a reason it's the key song, and that reason is that it's a theme song. No right, no wrong, no rules for me, I'm free. But you see, unless we become aware, this theme song will be the water to our fish. To finish, I want to say a couple of things about why this way of identity formation is not working. Number one, it's incoherent. We are told to look into our heart and our feelings and emotions to determine the order of things. Don't look to anyone else, just inside yourself. But here's the thing, your feelings contradict on small things and bigger issues. Your feelings contradict. You want to do well at work and you want to do well with your family. And sometimes they can contradict. Or for example, I'm a crazy person for mini eggs at Easter, but I also don't want to get fat. Those are two strong desires and they contradict. your desires and feelings are also constantly changing. What you thought makes perfect sense today looks like folly next year. Look back 10 years and we often cringe at ourselves back then. We try and hide and we say, how stupid could I have been? But like Tim Keller says, tongue in cheek, if we project forward 10 years and look back to today, we would probably also say, oh, how could I have been so stupid? So basically, we're stupid today and stupid changes almost daily. So how can basing an identity formation process on your constantly changing desires and feelings be sensible? It's not. It's incoherent. Second point. It's fragile. Taylor says it's incredibly fragile. He bases this primarily on the fact that in the postmodern identity, you are the ultimate validator. No one gets to tell you what's what, just you. But Taylor says also that we are irreducibly relational beings. And with that being the case, we cannot validate ourselves. And this is the big illusion of the modern identity, the attempt to validate ourselves. It's a huge trap and it catches so many of us. But spend any time in that space and you very quickly realize it's an echo chamber. And the result of this illusion of self-validation is that we are constantly nervous and fragile. It also means we are highly susceptible to the age of advertising and consumerism. If we're constantly in that place of anxiety and fragility, being able to wear certain clothes and look good in certain outfits makes sense. Because when we dress this way, drive that car, live in that house, holiday in that place, we are often saying, this is me, this is who I am, I can do this. And sometimes the subtext is, you cannot. We become suckers for advertising. It's also why it's very difficult to have a conversation with people who you disagree with. The modern identity is so fragile, and we've got to the point where it's not simply a disagreement with someone, it's taken as an attack. People flip out and melt down and go to pieces. So it's incoherent and it's fragile. Three, modern identity is fragmenting. With everyone making up their own version of right and wrong, there is no doubt that our societies are fragmenting. There is no one moral order that we all agree on. Tim Keller quotes an American author of a book on parenting called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenting. Her basic premise is that the modern identity is making parenting almost impossible. The reason why this is because the modern identity believes that every relationship is negotiable, including marriage. I stay in a relationship as long as it benefits me and it's working for me. As soon as that stops, we're out. The author goes on to say that the one relationship that doesn't fit into that modern identity is parenting. It's not like you can turn to your four-year-old and say, well, sorry, money's tight. The senior management team here have met, and unfortunately, you're now at risk of redundancy. You have 30 days where we'll try and help to find another role for you, but it just doesn't work, right? And the author's point is that the modern identity is making not only good parenting almost impossible, it's causing a great fragmentation in society. And that leads me to my last point, which is that basically the modern identity is an illusion. It says to look inside yourself, to find yourself. But in reality, to a great degree, it's the culture that is determining those things for you. For so much of our world today, it's this cultural moment that is determining what is good and what is right. And the irony is that it's the culture that says to go inside yourself, to find yourself. When in reality, it's the culture itself that determines what is acceptable and to a degree how we feel about ourselves and our world. And so the modern identity is incoherent, it's fragile, it's fragmented, and it's an illusion. And that brings me to the end of part one on identity formation. Today we looked at identity formation through culture. We contrasted the traditional identity with the modern identity. And in all of this, I want you to be very clear that both of those identities, traditional and modern, as we spoke about them today, are how identity is formed through culture. Next week, part two, we look at identity formation through Christ. It's unique, and it's really important to understand that the Christian identity is not a return to the traditional identity. Both the traditional and the modern identities, as we have discussed them today, are alternatives to the Christian identity. The reason we spent time on it today is that unless we understand how culture shapes and forms us, we very easily fall into the trap of reading our culture into the Bible, and we continue as the fish in the water. So my prayer is that today has been illuminating and helpful and sets us up for our time next Sunday in a useful way and enables us to really explore the wonder and the uniqueness of the Christian identity. Bless you and have a great week.